Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, and this is Aspen Public Radio's broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival. Coming up, redefining masculinity. Traditional notions of masculinity emphasize strength and power and devalue attributes like vulnerability and emotional openness. At a very young age, most boys learn that being successful means becoming dominant, that winning matters most, and that tears are a sign of weakness. But at this time of cultural and economic upheaval, male roles are beginning to shift. In today's world, when professional and personal achievement depends less on brute force and more on effective relationships, women are outperforming men on many measures. The Me Too revelations add new pressures to redefine masculinity and appropriate behavior. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. This is Aspen Public Radio's broadcast of Redefining Masculinity. The talk begins with moderator Pat Mitchell.
When Peggy first asked me about this, I really did leap at the opportunity. Because it is a conversation that we've been having my entire life, and I suspect among the men and women in this room as well. And unfortunately, it's a conversation that often gets caught in that power game of, well, if men win, women lose. If women win, men lose. And then we get stuck in these definitions of what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, and worse yet, they get defined as masculinity or femininity. And many of us talking this afternoon thought, well, femininity has been rejected by many women because it's been so polluted and distorted by the media. But so has masculinity. And tonight we have two extraordinary men who have taken their own journey through what it means to be a man, and have some really important insights and perspectives to share with all of us, and we will want to engage you in this conversation. But I'm going to start it off by introducing Jack Myers, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what he's done in a moment. But what I want to hear first, Jack, is I'm guessing you were raised in the 50s.
Yes, that's right.
So, with father, that father knows best.
No, I didn't exactly have that upbringing.
Okay, but tell us about your journey to what it means to be a man.
When I was 2 years old, my mom started working full-time, and was the only mom in the neighborhood, as much as I knew at that point, at 2 years old. And then at 9 years old, she started going to school nights, three nights a week, doing homework the other nights. My dad was very much a college administrator, low income, and my mom got her degree, got her master's degree, went on to get her master's degree, ultimately became one of the top computer programmers very early for the Air Force as a civilian. So as a child, I felt wanted, deprived. I didn't have a mom. Fuck you, mom. Seriously, for many, many years. And as she got older, and God bless her, she just had her 97th birthday, and is in great spirits and good health. And it pays back because now I see what a role model she was. How not only my mom, but my dad, who was very supportive, always advanced her career, always did what was best for her, and in that context, they had a great partnership. So I learned that I did not have that childhood, and then that was what I understood. That was the kind of feminism I understood and grew up with.
And from an early age, you watched a man and woman negotiate a different kind of relationship.
Well, yes, but I had my own conflicts around what a real man was, feeling embarrassed about my dad being, the softer, gentler, kinder dad that we all aspire to today. He was then in many ways, but also conflicted by his own demons. So it was really interesting to mature, and get to this point in my life where I'm looking at the realities of the polarization, the gender polarization, and thinking about this younger generation just coming out into their adult years. We call them Gen Z, or the internet generation, first group to grow up with the internet and mobile. And they're radically different. And they're caught in the middle between this question of traditional masculinity and femininity.
Right.
And they're in the middle, and they're very confused and conflicted about what's right, what's wrong, especially in this political climate.
And that's why we're so blessed, actually, in this conversation, to have another generation sitting right next to you. Jimmy was born two generations, I think, after Jack, and grew up in the 60s and 70s, right?
Yeah.
So during a bunch of social justice movements, including civil rights, including the women's movement. And so I can imagine, without really knowing, that your journey to manhood was quite different, but maybe not. So share that with us.
Yeah, thank you, Pat. In some ways, it was very parallel to Jack's. I mean, I grew up in Missouri, and two-parent home. My father was a blue-collar worker. My mother was a teacher, and without really knowing it at the time, I think a part of me was intuitively wanting to be a feminist, wanting to be a different kind of man, because I just remember in high school, throughout school and into high school, I was kind of the short, chubby kid with glasses and wasn't particularly athletic. I cried a lot. I was very sensitive. I was a sensitive kid in the class and our family. And at the same time, I grew up with some phenomenal, strong women around me, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother, who worked every day after school. So I think really the women in my life kind of infused me at an early age with a broader understanding of my identity or what my identity could be. And so I just, I was who I was. I didn't, I felt guilty. I felt challenged by the fact that I wasn't seen at that time as, a man or masculine man. my father, I was listening to what Jack said. My father, he was not the sensitive man. He's passed away now, but, from the South, one of 10 kids from Louisiana, raised by a single mom. And, I realized later on, near his passing, he himself had no model for fatherhood or healthy parenting. So I think, he was learning as he went along with me. And so, he tended to be much more traditional, stoic, show no emotion, don't say I love you, never said I love you until right before he died. Very little physical intimacy or contact, hugging, and so forth. My relationship with him was very challenged because of that, because I was the person who wanted to hug and kiss and didn't mind crying and showing my emotions that way. I think for me that really set me on a journey, especially growing up in the 70s and into the 80s, of wanting to really embrace my identity as a man, whatever that meant. I was open to the journey of discovering what that meant.
Jimmy Briggs, by the way, you went on to become a journalist and did some extraordinary work in Uganda, writing one of the premier books on child soldiers, and also started an organization called Man Up. And interesting the way you describe the challenges of your relationship with your dad and your being the sensitive man, boy, child who wanted to cry, who wanted to express emotions. So much of that informed the work of Man Up. What is the purpose of the organization? Now, you're no longer leading it, but it still exists and is working with boys in this country and men.
Well, really the impetus, Pat, came from what I saw, or rather didn't see, as a journalist. I spent a lot of time overseas. I worked at Life magazine for a number of years, before that the Washington Post. And while I was working on this book on child soldiers and war-affected kids, I was traveling to countries throughout Sub-Saharan Africa, throughout Central and South America, the near Middle East and South Asia. And though I was focusing on children in conflict and child soldiers, I was still paying attention to, the gender-based violence that was happening in these countries, particularly towards women and girls. And the gradual understanding that young men, young people, but young men and boys, were intuitively, independently resistant to what was happening in their communities towards girls and women, but there was no platform or framework to give them the space to be innovative, to engage their peers around transforming masculinity in that particular culture. So Man Up is an attempt to give young people the space to advocate, to educate their peers, to transform cultural norms based on where they are. So, you know, for me as a middle-aged man, it's not me going into a situation saying, this is how you should do it, but rather saying, asking them questions, listening, and asking, you know, what tools, whether it's music or art or sports, technology, what tools can they best use to engage their peers around healthy dialogue and transformational behavior?
And that kind of organization has had a lot to do with the generational differences that men and are feeling now, able to express their emotions, at least some. Many are still trapped in what that other great organization calls the man box. And Jack, at a very interesting time in your life, decided that what you wanted to understand was what were the generational differences between the way men looked at masculinity and their role in the world, and wrote a very important book about it called The Future of Men, Masculinity in the 21st Century, Men on Trial. And I invited Jack to give a TED Talk at TED Women a couple of years ago about it. And I think I remember your opening line was, when you told people you were writing The Future of Men, they said, do we have one?
Especially men ask that question. Yeah, and it's
both of you are going to have to hold your mics closer to your mouth, yeah, so that we can hear every word.
The Future of Men was published a little more than 2 years ago, and it fell on an audience, especially in media, where the response was typically men are not a story. And in the last 2.5 years since the book was published, and the book actually predicted, not by calling it Me Too, but it, in the first chapter, the foreword actually, it predicts Me Too. Chapter one, the title is Men Are Even the Good Ones Bad. Chapter six is Deny, 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 Men's Destructive Instinct to Lie. It was a very honest book about men. And the audience just was not ready to hear that message. Here we are with the Me Too movement still raging, and its tentacles will be hopefully long and wide, because there's really a purification, in many ways, to use not a positive word, of the soul, I think, in terms of what we stand for as and what masculinity stands for. And there's a raging conflict that we're really experiencing between a more traditional model of negative patriarchy, and defined in many ways as male dominance, and what is perceived as something that's less than masculine. And the younger generation that you work with, and we talked about this earlier, are heavily female. You mentioned 70, briefly about the high school graduation you just attended.
Yesterday afternoon in New York, I gave remarks at a high school graduation in Midtown West Manhattan, and it was a very small class. It was a charter school, and I didn't realize it until I looked, was on stage, but this graduating high school class was about 70% female, 30% male. And in talking with the teachers and administrators of the school, a lot of the grades, junior, sophomore, freshman, mirror those same numbers.
Yeah. And that's so what you found in your research.
And the real understanding that the book leads to is that we have an educational crisis in our country around boys and young men. 60 to 70% of high school graduates around the country, especially in lower economic areas, boys are graduating at record low rates. Colleges are 60 to 65% female. And in 13 of the top 15 growth industries, more than 60% of the employees are female. And all of this is positive. This is really healthy, in my opinion, economically, by every standard of society that we look at, not except political. This is positive, strong, and all the indicators are that it should continue. But there is an expense being paid by young men that we're not recognizing, we're not acknowledging, and we're not supporting them. And most importantly, at the earliest grades, we're not adapting our educational system to respond to the unique needs of young boys. And educators will tell me there are solutions, gaming in the schools, more computer, at-home learning opportunities. There are many opportunities and solutions that we're not taking, and this is, in this context, is a healthcare crisis in our country that we're fundamentally ignoring. And with the positive work that's being done and that the women's movement has done for the last 60 or 70 years, we need women to step up in this role of supporting young men and boys more proactively.
And Jimmy, is it all the situation, the circumstance, the data that Jack just shared, is all of that worse in communities of color? And if so, what is changing there? Where, how are you addressing the challenges?
Yeah, thank you, Pat. It's interesting because from our breakfast this morning, we were the three of us were speaking, and then attending the sessions this afternoon, certain things I heard in different sessions, including yours, really kind of helped me focus in on what you're saying, what you're asking, because I think several things are in play. One, and I can't speak for all communities of color, but within the African American community and Latino community and other communities of color that I have spent time in as a journalist and writer, as an advocate, I think there's several things in play. One, the notion of trauma, historical trauma. I did a story recently for Vice magazine on trauma among young men of color in New Orleans. And it was interesting. I was talking to people in New Orleans and nationally, and mental health professionals were telling me one of the reasons that we're seeing so much trauma in young men of color is because many public health experts and physicians and counselors don't believe that young men of color feel pain the same way as their white counterparts, which is also why young people of color tend to be prescribed fewer drugs for pain than their white counterparts. And it's interesting, spending time with these young men in New Orleans of different backgrounds, they expressed to me the desire to change, not in these words, but to change or thwart this masculinity thrust upon them, because the situations they're living in, they felt like they couldn't be vulnerable, they couldn't cry, they couldn't ask for help or go to a counselor, because often I would hear things like going to a counselor or psychiatrist is something white people do, or if I express my emotions, if I break down, whether it's because of socioeconomic stress or violence or everyday life stress, I'll be seen as weak, I'll be seen as less of a man. My male peers will call me soft, or I'll be less than. And so, even when there's a desire to transform oneself for the purpose of getting the help you need in terms of social emotional wellness, those cultural barriers are there. And they're not just internal cultural barriers, they're barriers also put on these young men by society at large by saying your pain is, you don't feel pain the same way we do, so you can cope, you're resilient, you can get through this, even when they're not.
And earlier today we did have a panel in which Linda Villarosa, who's written a really important feature article about the effect of trauma, the effect of racism, microaggressions, of experiencing that day in and day out, actually weathers one's aging process and one's ability to fight disease. Right. Is that a phenomenon that you're also seeing among black men of color?
Yeah, I think beyond black men, I think men of color, I was thinking about this, I have to confess, I went back to my room and took a nap. But I put on Netflix and I was watching Dave Chappelle comedy special. And this is important. No, this is important because I was watching this Dave Chappelle comedy special, and he actually, he was talking about Me Too and masculinity. And I think that he expressed something which I've been thinking about for a while and thinking about writing about it. And I'm sure Jack has touched upon this as well. But I think, when you talk about race, I think it's something that goes beyond men of color. Mm-hmm. If I may posit this idea, I think all of us, men of color, white men, white women, women of color, are ultimately impacted by a larger system of white supremacy. I'm not saying racism, but white supremacy. And I think we're all everyone in here is a victim of it in some way. Mm-hmm. We're victims of it, and to varying degrees, knowingly or not, we're complicit in the sustaining of the system. So I think, talking about race is important to get to the talking about white supremacy, because under white supremacy, we can talk about patriarchy. We can talk about xenophobia and racism and all these other things that really kind of trap us and take us to a deeper level of the conversation.
And we know that we have never been in a period of time in this, in our lifetimes anyway, where the polarization between all of us, of all ages, all communities, seems to be growing around all kinds of divides. And one of them is around this, the issue that we're discussing now. And Jack, you said something in the book, you write about it and you talked about it. Part of this has led young men, young white men in particular, to move further and further toward these evangelical, conservative, right-wing political points of view.
Well, speaking at this festival next week is Jordan Peterson, who's written one of the top best-selling books, 12 New Rules for Life. And even in the little biography in the Aspen Institute program, it refers to him as a gateway to the alt-right. And he couches his message in biblical terms. His message in many ways feels very spiritual, and in many ways he packages it so that it appeals to women. They think if their husband, boyfriend, lover, friends, sons read this book, it'll help them, because men are struggling today with self-identity. What they don't realize if they don't read the book themselves is it's chock full of arguments of why and how men should continue to be dominant and women should not be, should be more subservient. But that message is being heard by young men who are packing halls, listening to him and following his new gospel of fight back. And that's the fundamental message of the TED Talk, the TED Women Talk. It was, we need to be careful about a backlash against the women's movement among a generation, a post-internet generation, that is the most self-proclaimed feminist in history.
I do have to, I keep having these flashbacks, thinking I'm having this conversation with women who would be arguing the point that we haven't made quite as much progress as it might, is easy to assess from some of the victories that are important and accomplishments, but we still know the numbers at the top aren't significant. But then I think of this man. I assume everybody knows who we're talking about. Yeah. White and young white men are flocking to his lectures and reading his books, but so are white women. And this is what I'm struggling to understand. So any ideas about this? What's this about?
It's
a man who's saying women are subservient.
It's a natural part of cultural evolution when you have a metamorphosis or the kind of transformation we're having in society. It's a long-term process. It's decades, and we're probably going into the 50th or 60th year of this transformation. And in fact, there are actually genetic points to this, that geneticists will say we have just passed a moment in a 250,000-year projected history of humanity. We've just passed the midpoint, and that there is a genetic reality of what we're seeing in society, culture, business, in terms of women being recognized as just being better at certain things that are more relevant to society, culture, business today. And men need to be appropriately trained into those skills, competencies, where they are needed, like teaching and nursing and other things that are more stay-at-home dads. They are increasingly needed, but as a society, the media, the culture, education is doing nothing to help us men move along that path toward being better dads, better husbands, better sons, better lovers, better friends, better colleagues, and that's what we really aspire to.
Have to talk about media anytime you talk about the definitions of masculinity or what women want. Jimmy?
I just want to just piggyback on what Jack said as a question and a comment, because I wonder, and I'll tell you a brief, dealing with right now, but I wonder to what degree, I know for myself I have my own theories, but I think fear of altered status or position. I mean, we know from the polls, I think Pew had a recent study about this, looking at the typical voter for President Trump, and a lot of it was not socioeconomically driven, as we've been told, but it was because of fear of society changing, becoming more diverse, women's ascendance of non-traditional fields, more minorities and immigrants coming to the country, that fear was the basis for that. And I wonder, you know, fear for men broadly, at the imminence of women assuming roles of leadership that were previously barred to them. I'll give you a brief mini kind of example from young men, actually. I have a daughter who's 17, and I'm 6'3", and she's 5'3", in cleats. And she recently tried out for the boys' football team in her high school and made the team. Now, she's the only girl on the football team, tackle football, first girl ever on the football team. And, you know, I talked to her regularly about how the boys, how are they dealing with this, what are they saying. And over time, when she first went out for the team, they were saying, you know, most of them were saying, girls aren't supposed to play football, she's going to take away attention from us, this is not, girls should not be playing with us, you know, this is not for them. And over time, you know, through practice and her own training, she's starting to slowly get converts. But, you know, this notion that even for these young boys who are growing up in Gen Z, who are supposed to be so enlightened, so open to change, the fact that this 5'3" young woman could challenge their position, could challenge their mm-hmm. attention, you know, it's surreal to me. I get it, but it's also surreal as well.
It's really a fascinating. It's a fascinating shift that's slowly taking place. I've been doing research on this Gen Z for a decade now, and we've been tracking their politics. And during the Obama era, there was a heavy intention to vote. There was a heavy intention to vote more left than right. And today we're seeing, actually, among this new voter, a smaller percentage, about a third, saying they plan to vote. And they're about equally split in the different political camps. So they're reflecting society as opposed to what I hoped for from this generation as I've studied them, leading society. And that's because we are, as a culture, society, business, education, holding them back. We need to let them come out. They're new. They're a fresh generation. Let's empower them.
And you think they're coming into manhood or adulthood with a different concept of what they will have to do to be a man in the world, they will want to navigate
that? I absolutely believe they are. The men in this generation are self-proclaimed feminists. They recognize but they're confused because no alternatives are being presented to them. And no one is talking to them and saying, this is really not you. This is a societal reality. And I think that's a very similar, you know, kind of complexity that's dealt with. And to be comparing, you know, young men, and especially white young men, to the challenges is absolutely inappropriate, and that's not what I'm saying. But there are realities where there are comparable needs, issues, and priorities, including education.
I mean, you're right. I agree. I think, you know, James Baldwin wrote about what he called the light. And, you know, as he described it, the light is something that, basically, the light was a metaphor for love and empathy and, you know, the importance of elders, or soon to be elders, to hold that light and share it as a beacon, but also a resource for the younger ones. Yeah. And I think, you know, education is critical. We were talking about this morning. We have to educate and start early in education. At the same time, I think the work has to be done not just on Gen Z and those who follow, but also, frankly, on those of us who are Gen X, Boomers, Greatest Generation. Because, you know, and I talked about this a lot when I was at Man Up Campaign. I mean, and we did a lot of programs and workshops when I was there. But, you know, I saw early on that programming and education doesn't really stick. It's not really sustainable if, you know, you have these workshops or classes in school or after school, or maybe on weekends, maybe at camp. But then these young men of any race or ethnicity go back to their neighborhoods, go back home, go back to the church, the synagogue, the basketball court, the corner, whatever, and they're getting those same messages from their from the men that are in their lives saying, this is manhood, this is how you act, that's great for in that space, but here in the community, you gotta be a man in this way. Because if that message is not consistent, we won't have traction.
That's the perfect segue to the redefining masculinity and the need to really understand that masculinity is a spectrum, and there are many places on that spectrum, just as gender is increasingly recognized as a spectrum. You know, within the male sector, there as within the female sector, as within the all the other sectors. You have so many different definitions of gender and how people self-identify today, and we need to allow, empower men to step up for who they feel they are and have answers, role models, support. And that's utopian in so many ways in the political environment that we exist in today, where we have a role model that, in my opinion, is sending all the wrong signals to young men, and I believe it's incredibly dangerous. When lying is accepted, and there's, I mentioned the chapter in my book, for a young generation who's so open and in need of direction and guidance, when they've been told their whole life, you know, it's okay to cheat, it's okay to lie, boys will be boys, you know, that's the way to get out of trouble. And then they come into their adult years and they're saying, tell the truth. And then they're given this vision of the leader of the country saying, it's okay to lie, boys. It's okay. You're okay, boys. The way you've been, the negative patriarchy you've seen and not understood your whole life, that is the future. It is incredibly dangerous. We're not addressing it in the ways that the public and the nonprofit world needs to look at.
Jack, I'm curious, and I have to admit,
Sorry for that.
I have to admit, I have ordered on Amazon, but I have not read your book yet. I have to confess that, but
it's okay as long as you bought it on
Amazon.
Buy it,
so
okay.
We'll be there when I get home. It should hopefully will be. You know, I'm curious, like in your studies, you know, because I always ask this anecdotally when I go to schools or talk to young men and boys and girls as well. That's critical. You know, for me growing up with my father and with my peers, we never had any formal conversations about being a man. I wonder, you know, the young people, especially Gen Z, are they actually talking about this is what a man is or this is how to be a man? Because for me, maybe for some in this space, it did happen, but we never had a conversation about this is what a man is or this is how you go about being a man or a man does this. It was just like you had to figure it out by what was happening around you.
Yeah, well, I have the same thing. It's a really good question about Gen Z. And there's certainly more openness and more awareness because of the internet. An average three-year-old knows today more than I knew at 19, I think. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but they're exposed to sexuality in many ways that are not at all positive and are also contributing to a confused sexuality. I know the opening line of my book is, you know, most men, a single woman talking to another single woman, most men are either married, gay, or fucked up. And most of the married ones, and most of the married ones are fucked up too. You know, so unfortunately, that's the perception of men that's being communicated.
I can see why they ask you if they have a future.
And, you know, you have media portraying men for the last two decades as buffoons, idiots, sexists, misogynists, and commercials. And we really need to put forward more positive images of men in ways where if dads aren't available to talk to their sons and daughters about sex and sexuality, then we need media to find positive ways to do that, and that's where.
Ooh, let's don't leave it
in
to the media.
Yeah, well, that's so true, Pat.
Yeah. I do want to bring the audience into the conversation at this point, and even though we don't want this to go down the road of a political conversation, we do know the current occupant in the White House has certainly given a different definition to what it means to be a man as well as a leader. And that plus a lot of other currents, like the Me Too movement, like Time's Up, there is an equilibrium balance that seems to be out of balance at the moment. And it may be about language as well as about the cultural narrative that media is betraying. But I'm going to have to ask for the lights to come up a little bit in the audience because we can see none of your faces. And there is a microphone, I think, on each side of the room. And this would be a good time to just get your points of view and perspectives. But we want questions for these two men on the stage, and then I want to come back with some others that are on my mind too, but I want to make sure we're going in. I think I do see a mic. If you wait for the mic to get to you, that will be a clue. Yeah, there you go.
You know, you've just said that our current situation in the White House is a reflection of what a man is. And I have two boys that are 9 and 12, and we've used it as a great opportunity to discuss what a man possibly isn't, or what not a man, because we don't differentiate between men and women, but what a person and what a leader is and should be and is not. And this could be an aberration. And, you know, even though the election didn't go the way that I personally wanted it to go, my husband and I said, you know what, maybe he'll surprise us. We hope that he does. Maybe this will be an opportunity. But it's also a daily learning opportunity for my kids that perhaps we would not have had otherwise in listening to the news of saying, perhaps this was good and they're not getting enough credit, and perhaps this is a time for you to say this is not.
Let's try not to make judgments about the job the president is or isn't doing, because it will take us into a completely different conversation. We'll be redefining something else. But I love what you said about seeing this as a learning opportunity. That's what these two have been talking about all day.
And I commend you, and I pray that more men and women take the path that you've taken in communicating that. But we have to keep that in context, that 53% of white women voted for Trump and a similar percentage continue to support him. So there are a majority of white mothers out there who are unfortunately maybe communicating something different to their sons. And that's the fear that I have. What are those young men learning, and what happens as a result of that learning? So thank you for what you're doing.
Comment, Jimmy?
I think, you know, representation, and, you know, I'm an adult now, and I was in 2016. I don't know, I wonder, I'm sure there's studies around this, I wonder how many young men across the spectrum of ethnicity and race and economic status actually are impacted by the representation of manhood or leadership of the current occupant of the White House. Because growing up, I was just thinking about when you were saying that, ma'am, I was like, who did I look up to? I mean, my father, yes, but also in the media. Like, I think I became a journalist partly because of Ed Bradley. Like, watching him in 60 Minutes with my family, like, I just thought, wow, like, that's amazing what his job, what he does. And, you know, at the same time, I watched him on TV, but I also went to school in a district that had to be court-ordered desegregated. So I never grew up having a teacher of color or a male teacher of color until I got to college. And I feel like, you know, I often feel like the models of representations of healthy personhood or manhood or womanhood are so close to us, but we don't hold them up the way we should. Yeah. Because maybe they're not the President of the United States. Maybe they're the deacon in our church, or the rabbi, or the mailman who, you know, always has a smile and is very professional and is empathetic. Like, they're role models all around us. We just have to see them for who they are.
You said mailman. You had many things that were male, were masculine there, which we do need more of. But women are going to increasingly be the necessary role models. More than 50% of Gen Z have grown up with a mother as a primary or so, or equal wage earner. So we're seeing a different culture in this generation, and they have grown up seeing the world in a gender equal, in gender neutral context. So I think we really need to start trying to bring their beliefs into our culture rather than trying to impose on them what we believe.
The fastest growing population of mothers are single mothers who are choosing not to marry with children. So you're right, the role model is going to be a woman in the majority of households going forward, according to statistics I read today. Was there a question over here? I thought I saw a mic.
It's over here.
Okay, there was one over there.
We're parents of young adult men, and we're hopeful that we can convey at least one thing that they'll remember. But if we were to try to have one or two conversations with them, what are the most important conversations we should have?
How old are they?
18 to 23.
Such a great question. Thank you.
That's an amazing question. One of the challenges I think that we're also seeing is kind of a gender bifurcation between a lean-in generation of young women and a lean-out generation of young men. So given your two sons, would you consider that either or both of them to be lean-in, lean-out?
All three are probably leaning in.
All three are lean. So there's a girl in there too?
All boys.
Yeah, well, basically, there's a generation of, and I want to get to the answer to that, and so I'll be very brief here, but there's young men are only 40% of college graduates, about 40% of high school graduates, especially in lower economic areas. Those percentages are more skewed toward females. So basically, because they're not being educated at the same rate, they're not finding the same job opportunities, and they're becoming frustrated and confused. So that's defining. So you have three lean-in boys, and I would say that the irony is that the opportunities long-term have never been greater, because there is going to be a swing back, and there's going to be a dearth of skilled young men in their 30s who are competent to also move forward as organizations become more female-centric, because those are the right business decisions. And as we move toward more equality, I think we're going to see a move back to young men. So my message to them, ironically, would be hang in there, do a great job, be committed, be supportive, be feminists, because the women are going to be responsible for your success, growth, and elevation in whatever you choose to do.
What are lean-in boys is a question that came from the audience. I think
that's a great, great question. And I'm not the right person. I wish I could answer that, but because most of my work has been on the other side of that spectrum, a lean-in boy, in my opinion, is very different than a lean-in boy in a different household. My lean-in boys are looking at the opportunities going forward. They believe in pay equality. They believe in multicultural equality. And they're doing whatever they feel right about in terms of their careers and their growth. And they're empowered to move forward. My concern is that too few boys are feeling empowered today to move forward. So I'm sorry to occupy
Is that what you're observing in your communities?
Well, I was going to say something kind of tangentially. And I love the question about lean-in boys. I won't try to answer that. I thought what you said was great, Jack, about lean-in boys. I two things. One, this is a question, but also just kind of putting it on the table. And you possibly address this in your book, Jack, privilege. This privilege in this conversation, because, I mean, and I'm not saying you were doing this, but I think we talk about economically challenged, I mean, you weren't doing this, but economic challenges communities, usually that we mean communities of color, which is not always, obviously not everyone of color is economically challenged, but it raised something in my head, because I think the economically challenged part is interesting. We talk about privilege and what privilege means as a man. You know, if you're white, what privilege means to the man? If you're South Asian, or Latino, or African American, or Indigenous American, I think privilege can trigger different reactions around Me Too or around conversations of masculinity. Also, I'm doing a story right now for the Washington Post about this, but I'm wondering more and more if this opioid crisis that we're talking about in recent years, if a big factor of that is, I guess, crisis or trauma around shifting privilege in communities that are economically challenged, particularly white communities that we're seeing in rural and urban areas, but this shifting privilege where people aren't getting the jobs they feel they should be getting because they're men, because they're white men, or shifting privilege because the focus is not on them as much as it used to be.
Really insightful, yes.
But that is always what we end up when we talk about men and women. It's women gain, the economy is moving towards women's more natural instincts and abilities. That's a loss for men, and many young men. I have grandsons and sons in that age group, and there's a fear that there aren't as many opportunities. So I think parents are struggling to find what are the things you say
when
to
I was
young
at Man
men.
Up, I'm sorry, Jacob, quickly.
No, please.
When I was at Man Up, I spent so much time, Pat, talking to young men and boys, not only in this country, but internationally, because it was just what you said. It was seen as a transactional thing. If women are allowed, not that women aren't born with inherent rights for equality and dignity, but you know the framing was, if women are allowed to do certain things or have certain opportunities, what do I give up? You know, but not that it wasn't seen as an issue of common humanity. It was more like I have to give up something if they're going to get this. You know,
a quick comment. If I were living in West Virginia, a 15-year-old boy or girl, and I was given a choice, all right, you can grow up and be a coal miner, or you can grow up and be a teacher, a nurse, or do something that gives back to society, whether it's a nonprofit or an organization that helps the local community. Which would you rather be, a coal miner? And you're going to be paid the same. You're going to be compensated the same. What percentage do you think would say, no, I want to be a coal miner? But yet, we agree to support the coal mines, but take money away from education and health care in order to do that. And even if there's not a direct quid pro quo, that's the way the system is working right now. And it's screwed up.
And so much of that is based, though, on a generational concept of what a man does. He goes into the coal mines to support his family,
right,
as his grandfather and the father
before
him.
We've got a canary in the coal mines, and it's this young Gen Z who we need to pay more attention to, men and women.
And you're convinced they're going to take us into a world where we are redefining masculinity, as well as the relationships, because you can't talk about masculinity in the absence of discussing the relationship, especially now, and this is the subject I want you both to talk about a bit. We are in a time of gender progression, and you know there's so many definitions of men and women on the gender in the spectrum and in the ecosystem now. So how is that affecting the concept of what it takes to be a man? What does a man do or feel?
Well, it's putting young men right in the crosshairs of this generational shift. And it's not like we can dramatically overcorrect or correct at all, because we're still on that path toward, we're far away from pay equality. We need to get there. We're far away from C-suite representation of women. Multicultural representation is an embarrassment to our country, and yet we are not making significant progress on a lot of those needs. So I think in terms of what we do and where we are, we need to look at these younger generations. First of all, help young men feel accepted and a part of society when they go into an organization, give them the same mentoring that the women get. But we need to start looking at the youngest generation being born today and restructure the educational system from the ground up to better serve their needs.
Do you guys know about this system in Iceland, where they have taken 2 and 3 year olds and they start them in a school system in which there is no gender of any kind? There's no gender in the books. Every week, the boys wear pink and do all the so-called girl things. And the next week, the girls, the boys, they're constantly switching the roles as they go into, even at that age, thinking boys do this, girls do that.
Wow.
But no one quite knows what that's going to look like when that generation enters adulthood.
But it will be interesting. It will be.
Should we be doing more of that gender-neutral education?
Well, I think we are. I think that exists in more and more in schools,
yes,
and colleges, you know, groups for, you know, different degree for LGBTQ,
you found that
gender-neutral, and so on. And that's, I think we are seeing in this younger generation a recognition that gender is not how they judge each other.
I don't know how many of you have had your millennial or Generation Z grandchildren or children say to you, I'm gender blind. I always say to the girls, y'all come back at 40 and tell me how gender blind you are. The experience of living, it does not completely make it, we don't live in that world yet. So is it a matter of terms? Is it a matter of language? And I want the audience to jump in here. I saw a question over here that I don't think got, you didn't get the mic yet, so take it, and then I'll come back to you.
So how much do you think that part of the problem is that men still have biological or societal programming about being a provider, and in the face of, not necessarily lean in the face of more women going to college and more women being accomplished and whatever, they're lost in a world trying to figure out how do they be a provider in that. And they may say, I want a woman who's intelligent, I want a woman who's self-sufficient, but when they get them, they don't know what to do with them. Right. So, I'm not trying to be sarcastic.
No, it's a good question.
You know, but I think it's a problem in terms of finding their place in that world,
yeah,
where they get to be a man and feel a sense of accomplishment in their own right and feel secure in that.
We have a couple of questions back here, so you might.
Okay. Yeah, let's do. Well, can't see you, but please.
Yeah,
we'll take two more. And then I'm going to come over here and take two over here, but we'll answer in between.
I have a question and a comment, and my intent is, I'm over here.
Okay, sir.
My intent is not to be confrontational, but my concern is that I've noticed a theme of some words that have been thrown around, and I truly believe that words have power, especially in this day and age where everything is shortened down to X number of characters. And those words include things as natural, evolution, genetic, biological, and this continuous, I guess also I want to highlight this theme of what appears to be a crisis narrative for men, because that has great parallels, I believe, with this movement towards white supremacy that's occurring in our country today. So if you could please address that, I think that would be great.
That's such a good question. Can we just stop and take that?
Okay. No, I was going to say, thank you so much. We're in sync right now because you're in my mind. We're in sync for Chicago. I was just thinking that, right, what you were saying before you said, I was thinking that because, you know, frankly speaking, I mean, frankly speaking, it's always weird to me. I always feel funny. I love conversations like this, especially when we can get outside of the bubble of our spaces. You know, I feel like often, and Pat and Jack both know this, I feel like, not now, but I feel like we're often talking amongst our community, within our community. It's like an echo chamber. So this is great, but I often feel, I always feel a little bit funny, a little bit awkward, because you're exactly right. I feel like we're talking about a crisis and, you know, this particular care and understanding this depth of compassion for men when women have been dealing with this for centuries, since the beginning, you know? So it always feels weird to me, like, even on Me Too is barely a year old, but still we're seeing such a backlash among men towards Me Too. And so I think you're right. I think the language is critical. I think, you know, crisis, male crisis, it's problematic. I'm not saying it's wrong to use or it's inaccurate, but I think it's problematic and probably triggering or traumatizing for women when, you know, when we're still not at a correction. You know, we're still trying to get to the place of equality.
That's a great comment so we can get
those other questions. I agree it may be traumatizing to women, and I agree that the word may or may not be overplaying the reality as I applied to it in education among young men, and what I see is a continuing trend that will accelerate and become more and more of a problem, like a disease. But on the other hand, I recognize the challenge. The problem with the reality that words are powerful is that my book came out 2.5 years ago, and I had a very soft, friendly message that I communicated, and all I heard was, men are not a story. We're not interested in men. Well, I'm interested, and it's not a most comfortable position always to be in, because I always consider myself a feminist. But the quick answer is, unfortunately, we need to start using very strong words that may or may not have ripples and repercussions that are uncomfortable. But I think we need to create a little bit of discomfort around the issue. And I'm talking about men of all color, and I'm talking about multiple gender definitions of both male and female who are looking for better acceptance in this world. And we can, all I'm saying is don't leave young men, and because it's the reality, white men, out of the conversation. Where they wind up in that conversation is up to society, culture, and the men themselves, but don't leave them out.
Well, we're going to leave out a lot of ideas and questions because I just got that horrible sign of 0 minutes left. And clearly masculinity is not a subject, or the future of men is not a subject, or the crisis narrative that we seem to be developing and talking about that we can handle in an hour.
And can I just, since I've been sitting with this on the table all night, thank you for being here, and thank you to the Aspen Ideas Festival for hosting us. Thank you for this conversation.
So I tell you what I would love, and maybe Peggy in the audience would agree with me. I'd love to know what word we could use to have this conversation, redefining masculinity by coming up with a new word, a new term. So let us hear from you about that. That was one of the questions we wanted to open up for this audience. Thank you all for being here, and
have a good night.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.